Welcome to Let's Talk Micro.
Hello, dear audience. Welcome to another episode of Let's Talk Micro. As always, I hope you had a great week. And you can always find Let's Talk Micro on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Good Pods, whatever you listen to podcasts, you can find Let's Talk Micro. As for our social media, I am on Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube as Let's Talk Micro, on LinkedIn as Luis Plaza, on X as Let's Talk Micro 1, and I have an email address which is letstalkmicro@outlook.com. So either via email or via social media, you can send out any feedback, any suggestions. Those are always welcome and appreciated. So please go ahead and subscribe to the podcast, download episodes, and if the app allows you to do so, please go ahead and leave a review. Thank you so much for the support. As always, if you are looking to learn more about antibiotics, please check out www.learnantibiotics.com and the Learn Antibiotics book, available on Amazon. These resources include cheat sheets, practice tests, games, and more, and they are being used by thousands of people worldwide and may be helpful for you or your colleagues. Great resources from Dr. Timothy Gauthier, a very passionate pharmacist. And as you know, the Let's Talk Micro podcast does not have any sponsors, so if you want to support the podcast in any way, you can do so via Venmo link or by buying a coffee, KO-FI, both links available on the show notes. But thank you. If you haven't checked out the previous episode, please go ahead and do so. It was a great episode where I had two guests, two microbiologists from the CDC, Center for Disease Control and Prevention, and they joined the podcast to talk about the AR Isolate Bank, AR, which stands for antimicrobial resistance. And maybe those of you that might have been working on a project or a validation at some point in time, and you might have requested some organisms from the CDC, and you saw that the vials had the designation AR. So that's where those isolates come from. So in the podcast, they talk about what the AR isolate bank is, what type of organisms can you find, you know, what was the purpose of creating this isolate bank. All in all, it was a great episode with some great content, so definitely check it out if you haven't already. Today's episode is a little bit longer than other episodes than normal, so I'm just going to be brief, but it's about an MLS program, Medical Laboratory Sciences program that's located in the University of Alaska in Anchorage. So in the episode, I am joined by the program director, Grace Luberg, which she also teaches microbiology. And she talks about the program, you know, what kind of program it is. She talks about the microbiology curriculum and something very interesting that she has the students doing, which is research. And the research program, you know, has a lot of information. So she's going to come at some other point in the podcast to talk about it more in detail. But she talks about, you know, the samples, and they do susceptibility testing on the stool samples, and they, you know, they look for things like antimicrobial resistance. All in all, great information, and I do love what Grace is doing with the students, and she's really preparing them, and the way that, you know, she's getting them to do critical thinking in microbiology and building a foundation with the organisms and biochemicals and susceptibilities. So I think that they come out well prepared. You know, building that confidence, which is something very important that we need to have as medical laboratory scientists. In the episode, she also talks a little bit, you know, she gives her story, you know, as far as how she became an educator, what inspired her. I mean, she spent 35 years working as a medical laboratory scientist before she decided, you know, to become an educator. So it's a great story. All in all, a great episode. Let's go ahead and listen to it. Well, listeners, from time to time, you know, we, besides talking microbiology, and we're talking a little bit of microbiology today, sometimes, you know, we talked about different medical lab science programs. And recently, I was listening to a podcast called Off the Bench from the ASCLS, and they had a guest, and she was talking about her program, and she was talking about the research the students do at their program, and I found it very interesting. So I reached out, and here we are. So with me today, I have Grace Luberg from the University of Alaska Anchorage Medical Lab Sciences Program. Grace, welcome to Let's Talk Micro.
Welcome. Thank you so much for inviting me to speak, Luis. This has been exciting when I talk to the off-the-bench individuals, to not only to let people know what it's like to teach in Alaska, but to also, you know, what medical laboratory science is. So many times, people don't know what we do. You know, I always tell my students that we send them the bill, but they don't know where it came from. And so I really appreciate the opportunity to speak to other individuals in the greater wide world, and not only about Alaska, but about our field, microbiology and med lab science.
Yes, definitely. It's a profession that sometimes, you know, there's a lot of unawareness, and people kind of find out by the time they're done with their degrees and they come back. So as I said before in the podcast, you know, sometimes, you know, typical presentation, we have students that they already have completed a degree and then they come back. So it's always good, you know, to keep talking about MLS and definitely, you know, shout out to the Off the Bench podcast and Sophia, which I had the pleasure of being a guest one point in time. Thank you again. So for the audience, can you tell them a little bit about what you do?
Sure. So, you know, I'm a professor at the University of Alaska Anchorage, and I'm also the program chair here for our medical laboratory science program. But it's not like I went to college and woke up one day and decided I wanted to be a medical laboratory science educator. I tell my students that life is a process. And as long as you keep your options open, as long as you're always willing to learn something new, no matter what field you decide to go into, you will grow as a person and you'll grow in your field and you'll grow in your life. And so that's kind of what happened to me. In the very beginning, you know, I went to South Dakota to become a medical laboratory scientist way back in the 70s and 80s when it was still a kind of field that was dominated by women. But the reason I went to the college is that it was also a place that I thought about, you know, going to the convent. It was, Mount Marty College was a Catholic university and it was a good school, had a good med lab science program. But also I was thinking, you know, I might want to become a nun. Well, you know, I'm married and I have children and my husband always said he saved me from the convent. But my life didn't actually start out when I thought it was going to be. So I became a med lab scientist. I married a Swede Norwegian. So I wound up in Kansas. And in Kansas, I found a really great job as a medical laboratory bench technologist. But the interesting thing is that when I first came out of school, we were undergoing some changes in microbiology at the department or the hospital I was working at. And I still remember they said, great, new grad, we need to know all the new stuff. And so I was instrumental as a new grad to write the procedure manual for microbiology. And you have to remember, I wasn't really good at micro in my undergrad. And when it came to parasitology, I always said that if it didn't crawl across my field, I was never going to see it. And yet I had that opportunity. And so I took it way back where in the early, I'm 21 years old. And then I decided, well, I'll join ASM because they seem to know stuff. And so being given that responsibility and saying yes from the very beginning started my path always in micro. So although I was a generalist for my entire 35 years of medical laboratory science, I was always part of ASM. I was always part of micro. I was always learning new things. I was going to conferences. And in Kansas, we had the Southwest Association of Clinical Microbiologists was our ASM branch, SWACM, which I think is the best acronym there ever was. And that was the coolest, best group of individual microbiologists. And I'd go to their conferences. And it all started because when I came out of school, they asked me if I wanted to help write the procedure manual, and I said yes. So because of that and being part of ASM and, you know, being part of ASCLS and ASCP, I did all those continuing education classes. I grew in micro and I grew with the lab. And when we started bringing molecular into the lab when I was in Kansas, I realized I wanted to know more than the salesman, because, you know, salesmen are salesmen, whether they're selling you a car or they're selling you a chemistry analyzer, you know, they'll sell you anything. So I wanted to know more than the salesman. And Michigan State University started having this molecular diagnostics. And I discovered that the hospital would pay for some of this. And I'm like, well, this sounds kind of neat. I think I could do this. You know, I'm, you know, 40s, you know, I'm not that young, but I think I could do this. Oh my gosh, I had no idea what online learning was. I hadn't been to school since, you know, 1982. But I started and I really learned and I learned how much I didn't know. And I got through everything. And then I went on campus because they had their lab that they had their on-campus lab that we did for a week. And I was the oldest person there, except for a couple of the professors. And everybody else is young people. And there was one instance, and it was to respect older technologists. There was one, and nobody wanted to be my lab assistant. I mean, they were nice young people, but let's face it, I was a 50-year-old woman. Nobody wanted to be with a 50-year-old woman. And I get that. But finally, you know, I had a lab partner. We did okay, but one day we did an extraction, right? And we didn't extract the 40 microliters. We don't have enough for 40 microliters. We had enough for a good 35 microliters to be accurate. So I'm redoing the calculation so that we can do it with 35 microliters. And she's all upset. And she goes to the TA and she goes, I knew it. I knew it. She's messing this up. She's messing this up. She's changing things. So, you know, he comes over and says, what's going on, Grace? And I go, well, we don't have 40 microliters. We have 35 that are accurate. So I'm just changing it so that we can run it on 35 microliters. And he looked at her and he says, yes, Grace is old. And yes, Grace is a little bit slower on some things, but Grace knows lab math. So she knows her lab math. She knows she's doing it right and it's fine. So I finished. And when I was there, they at graduation, our little graduation, they said, you know, you're a third of the way to your graduate degree from Michigan State. And they were starting their online hybrid, you know, where I could take it online. And I thought, why not? And I talked to my husband and he says, well, we just graduated our last kid from college. So I've been paying tuition all this time. What's another tuition? And I was working full time in the hospital to pay a portion of it. So I got my master's degree while I was working, and I was still working second shift, and I was doing homework and having a thesis and doing all this thing and growing in this knowledge. I still can't amaze how much I still didn't know. Molecular has changed so much in micro. And I thought I was going to be beneficial to the workplace. And I suppose that's the one thing that disappointed me, that even though I was a generalist working second shift, doing micro, doing blood bank, doing everything and adding all this molecular piece, it just didn't get embraced like I thought I would. So I started doing some adjuncting. I liked it. I always volunteered in my kids' schools because I work second shift. So I just do little micro things for the high school. And I do some stuff in chemistry for the chemistry instructors there at the high school. So I'd been doing dabbling and teaching. And the one thing I did do when I was at Michigan State, because I could take electives, I took two electives in the education department, which was the smartest thing I did. One was, you know, teaching and leading. So it's the idea of what does teaching as a leadership mean and the philosophy of teaching and things like that. And then one was on teaching the non-traditional students. So in other words, teaching college age and those students that come back to college. And not only was it really a good way of understanding how teaching was and how you take what you know and be able to present it for somebody to understand it, which I felt helped me on the bench just as much as it did later on when I became a teacher. But those instructors were the nicest people. I was the only graduate student that wasn't in the Department of Education. But they let me, you know, they had an open seating. They let me come in as an elective. And they were the most supportive people I've ever been. Because sometimes in medicine, we can be a little Socratic. I mean, we can be a little bit mean, to be honest. Sometimes we're tough on our students. And we, you know, we want them to be, you know, we want them to excel. And so sometimes we don't always use that, you know, that supportive type of aspect to it. And so being surrounded by educators and this group that were very extremely supportive about myself as my outcome really benefited me as a medical laboratory scientist, thinking of my outcome and the people I was supervising on the bench, their outcome, looking at it at a different way than as a scientist where, yes, you have to have it right. Yes, you have to have protocols followed. You know, you need to have these student learning outcomes measured. We're going to measure you. We're going to assess you. But it was more of an academic, you know what I mean? More of a, how we are in medicine, like, you know, analytical. And here, learning assessment and learning about teaching and reaching people, and not in a soft and fuzzy way as much as in a holistic method that you as an individual, as a worker or a student are a holistic person and how you approach your outcome and how you can be a better person on the bench sometimes is a different set of skills. So it's wonderful classes I took. So I had some of those pieces together, and the University of Alaska Anchorage was looking for a microbiologist. They were looking for a tenure track, which at the time I was foolish enough not to know that that was really a tough position to get, that's tenure track. So it didn't occur to me not to apply for it. And I went ahead and applied. I had a really lousy second shift day at work. And so I logged off and I called my husband and I go, you know, I think I'm going to apply for this. And he said, go for it. And so that was 2016. I was finishing my master's degree. I was graduating from Michigan State. I was still working full time. I was finishing up my final papers that I was doing. And I was interviewing for the job at UAA. And it was a process of both, you know, written. And then we had a virtual, like this type of a Zoom that we also familiar with now, but back then wasn't quite as familiar. And then they flew me up for a 2-day on-site interview for a couple of days. And then for us to look around and then job offer. And so it was kind of a whirlwind, but it was a huge decision to then make that leap. So I tell my students that I graduated in May went to Michigan State to get my diploma because my husband said we're going to walk. So we drove up to Michigan State and I walked with all the other students. And I'm very proud of my master's from Michigan State. You know, go green, go white. Very proud of that degree. And then I went back to Kansas, worked until 4th of July weekend because I was scheduled for 4th of July weekend. And they were like, well, Grace, you were supposed to do 4th of July weekend, so you can't leave until 4th of July weekend came off. So kind of tell you the work environment I had at the time. And so I worked 4th of July weekend, and then we packed up the truck on Monday and drove across Canada and went to Alaska. And then I started teaching August 1st of 2016 and haven't looked back. I will tell you, though, my husband was in charge of the move because I was doing a lot. He was retired, and he was in charge of the move. And at one point, I thought, oh, how do I get to Alaska? So I typed in, you know, Salina, Kansas to Anchorage, Alaska. And I went out to the living room and I went, we have to drive through Canada to get to Alaska. Now, you have to realize I have a really bad sense of direction. Like, I always go the same way to stores so I don't get lost, even in my own town. So it's no surprise to any of our kids that mom doesn't know how to get to Alaska. But I really kind of had this idea in my head. And my husband goes, well, how do you think we're going to get up there? Of course, we have to go through Canada. And I go, I don't know, go to Seattle, take a right. And so everybody just laughs because if you ever look at it, it's a huge move. It's 3,000 some miles. It's over areas where there's only like one road. You know, you go through the Yukon and the Canadian Rockies. I mean, you're only on one road. And if I had known that, I don't know that I would have been brave enough. But I didn't know that. And my life, I didn't know that, not because I didn't want to know, because I gave that responsibility to someone else, which I learned in my graduate classes that sometimes that's a good thing to do, that sometimes it's important to accept other people's skills and let them to do that. As medical laboratory scientists, we like to think that we control the world, but sometimes we have to let somebody else do something. And so, yeah, so I made my way to Alaska and I've been here ever since.
Wow. So you definitely, you know, like you had a full career before you made this move. I mean, you worked many years in the bench and, you know, as you know, sometimes, you know, being an educator, it's just not everyone doesn't have the patience to do it, or sometimes, you know, it requires you a lot of times, you know, having an understanding and sitting there with the students, sometimes, you know, being asked the same questions over and over again. And it just, everyone, you know, even though you see this on the bench, sometimes, you know, when students are doing their clinicals, not all the techs, you know, they have the patience for that. So anything else that led you or inspired you to do that change at that point? I mean, after working so many years?
Well, so I've always been a second shifter. So when you're a second shifter, you're always getting the new grads. I mean, we always got the new grads from Wichita State or, you know, the travelers. I mean, the new grads always come on to second shift. And so I feel like I've always been in that role where I was trying to guide them, you know, trying to help them to be the best medical laboratory scientists that they could be. Because even though they would come in with a set of skills, often, you know, like any new grad, they needed guidance. And so I worked really hard to try to provide them with, so I always felt like I was always training, even when I wasn't a trainer on the bench. And I wanted them to do well because I wanted them to have confidence, maybe because I wanted them to have the confidence that I had when I was a new grad and I was okay with writing a procedure manual for micro. I don't know why I had that kind of confidence, but I wanted to give those students and say, you know, your education is good, and I'm going to give you this opportunity to build on that and to build on that confidence. I go, so I think some of it, I've always sort of had that in my life all the time. And like I said, I've always would do, you know, when they had the career days at school, can somebody come and do something? Since I work second shift, I always did that. I'd always go to the junior high and talk about med lab scientists, or I'd always work and maybe do a little demonstration for micro and the advanced, you know, chemistry classes and blood micro classes and biology classes they would have at the high school. Some of the advanced placement classes, I would do some things. And so I always was sort of in that teaching mode, and I helped to raise 7 children. And so my kids were always excited when I got the teaching because they said, well, now I have somebody else who's going to feel your fingers on their back, mom, because you always wanted us to do well. You always wanted us to have that education. You wanted us to grow, to learn. I mean, we're constantly wanting people to make that next step forward. I was such a person that wanted everyone to find the potential in themselves. Just how I am as a person is that we had a phlebotomist, and she was a really good phlebotomist, but I saw that she did a lot of really good literature reading. You know, I'd see her reading, you know, because we were downtime during the lab and she was reading this book. And I'm like, you know, have you ever thought about going to college? And she, no one had ever asked her that. She goes, well, I have a good job as a phlebotomist. I go, I know you do, but you have really good skills in reading and you might want to just learn more. And, you know, there's community college and you work second shift and you could just, you know, get general education to start out with. But I think you should go to college. So to learn, you know, to just to see what's out there. And there's more than just phlebotomy. And not just to be a medical laboratory or scientist. I mean, it wasn't that. It's just that she just, I could just see that she had more to grow. I said, there's more of you to grow. Well, she's a social worker now. And she got her master's in social work. And she still emails me occasionally. And she'll say, you know, Grace, you took that minute. So I still remember that you took that minute. We were busy. You were busy. And you noticed me. And you noticed me and you noticed that I had something in me that I didn't even recognize in myself. And so I think I've always been that kind of person. And it doesn't mean I'm a super person. It's just my personality. And so I think maybe that's the transition to teaching was a not an easy transition, but one that when the opportunity came, I thought that I might like it. Now, to say that I was this easygoing, not type A laboratory professional. So my kids never knew that I could swear until one time they came to see me in the lab and I came in and somebody had not ordered stuff and my blood bank refrigerator did not have enough O's and I was really pissed off. And you know, I'm a blood banker, I'm a scientist. It's stat. We need to get stuff, we need to get it done, needs to get done, needs to get done right. And so that's still there. And so that was probably the biggest transition, like you said, is I had to remember to meet the students where they were at and then build them up to that skill set. Because I have students that will come into micro that have never used a flame, have never used a loop, that have never labeled a plate. And so it's one of those things where that you need to make sure that you're breaking down your tasks so that they have things that will build onto themselves. And then make sure that they know the expectation that once they're taught that task, that then they're going to need to learn the next task will build on top of it. So it's not that everything is dumbed down, but it's placed at a level that they can develop confidence and competency and then move on to the next. I think sometimes the anxiety that our medical laboratory scientists have on the bench is that they have somebody come in and they don't have that type of background. And they don't know quite at that point how to break it down so that that student builds confidence. So they learn something and maybe they learn it wrong and then they feel bad and they might even get not necessarily yelled at, but you know, that stern talking that we all know how to do on the bench. And then they get scared to do the next task. So as an educator and something that partly I learned from taking those education courses I took in Michigan State. I will tell any individual that listens to this podcast that things at some time, I just think it was the best classes I took. Even if you are planning on never leaving the bench, but you're getting your master's degree in leadership or you're going to be a manager and you're getting your MBA, if you have an opportunity to take an education graduate level course in things like leadership and learning or, you know, like I said, the non-traditional student, anything along those lines, do it. Because some of the things that I learned about how to approach and how to establish a goal and how to reach that goal and recognize that individuals have different ways to reach that goal made me the instructor that I am. And again, shout out to Michigan State for letting me do that because that also helped. My natural tendency to want to bring people up to their best potential, experience with having had a lot of young students come out of med lab science schools, seeing kind of the gaps in their education, where if I was going to be an educator, maybe what I want them to have. And one of the things is that confidence that they're going to be dealing with patient samples and not just a mock-up. And that leap is kind of hard to make. So seeing that gap, that how I wanted to approach that. And then, you know, just learning to break things down and remembering to slow down. And that was that first semester. I always still feel sorry for those students that first semester. Because not only did I have to learn how to slow down, you know, teaching a skill, I talk really fast and I talk fast now, but I talked even faster then. So those things. But it became like I miss the bench. There are days that I'm looking at slides with the students and I'm helping them in parasitology and I'm humming a little bit because I'm trying to find that Entamoebi coli. And I'm like, gosh, I miss this. I mean, I miss that. I do. I miss my bench where it's quiet and I got all the stools I'm doing because I like doing O&Ps, which in itself is kind of weird, but I do miss that. But it's so important for us to also reach students that that part of me that wants people to grow and to do the best they can also made me a good, I think, a good educator and is why I'm happy with the job I have. So individuals, when they make that leap, again, it's a different skill set than when you're just even teaching somebody how to run the new Beckman analyzer and what the F function means this time. And we have this new software upgrade that takes some task. But when you're having somebody with no idea how to do something, a new student that comes on the bench, new grad that comes on the bench, how you approach them has to be not only the task, but also that soft skill is how are they approaching it themselves. So what do they bring that is strong and what do they bring that is weak? Are they, is their personality, hi, I'm here, can you teach me how to do this? Or is their personality like they're not even opening their mouth? And that really, you have to change to some extent how you approach them when you're going to teach that task. So that's, yeah. So I made, for me, the transition was maybe easier than others. I like to say I was doing it my entire life. But at the same time, yeah, it's always a challenge. But I think to some extent, it's no different than when you have someone with a PhD in chemistry and all of a sudden he's teaching chemistry. How many of us that are listening has had that chemistry, biology, math professor that had no idea how to teach, right? That just, you know, you were just lucky that you caught a good TA that helped you out. So that, I think, is the nature of university training in a nutshell anyways.
Yes, definitely. We do get our, yeah. At some point in time, we all had that one class or that were the other professor. It's difficult, and maybe doing the assignments or other things, you know, it helps you at the end get a good grade, because other than that, it's challenging. I like how you said, yeah, just with, you know, taking the time and understanding and yeah, we had some challenges, especially when COVID, that we had some students that took their microbiology class online. So when they came in, they had to get their microbiology, their microscopy skills. So we had to even take that step back further and say, okay, get them comfortable with just handling the microscope because they just took an online class. So, you know, definitely we have to, yeah, understand and then, well, as you said, you know, have them, you know, build that confidence, which is very important to the work that we do, you know, in all the areas. But in micro, if you don't have confidence, and it can be a really long day because, you know, it tends to be very gray. You have all those organisms growing on a plate. So you have to get to that point where you're comfortable enough seeing these things in and out and make the appropriate decision, which there's a human being behind that.
You know, when you say that about confidence, and I don't want to break in, but you're right, because some students have it. And you as a microbiologist, you know, the Staph aureus is the one that's coagulase positive, right? And so I'll be even in lecture class, I go, okay, we're going to run a coagulase and the coagulase is positive. So what is our organism? And they sort of like, Staph aureus. I go, no, say it again. They go, and then they're a little bit loud. I go, no, say it with conviction. You know, like you're at a football game. What is this? And they go, Staph aureus. I go, yes, it's Staph aureus. And because you have to do that, you have to, I go, guys, you got to be that confident. So again, catalase positive, coagulase positive. It is. And then they shout out Staph aureus. I go, that's exactly right. And so, because you're right, they don't want to be wrong. And in micro, you're at some point, you know, the rubber hits the road. And then I tell my students too, but then there's always that nice words, presumptive, potential. I mean, so sometimes when you're not quite sure, you know, there's always terms you can say if you're not quite certain, but you're right. Micro, it's not like chemistry where it's going to spit out an answer. And then you've got, oh, my QC worked, everything worked, I can report this out. In micro, sometimes your QC worked, and it says, you know, you're doing a slide coagulase test or you're doing a latex test, which can have some nasty cross reactivities if you're not careful. And it doesn't really look positive, but it's kind of grainy. And then you look and then you got to think, what do I have? And then that's where that critical thinking comes into play. And then your confidence, looks like a duck, acts like a duck, is probably a duck. Or, you know, this doesn't really look like a Staph aureus on the plate. Maybe I need to do something different. So, yeah.
Yeah, you definitely build a good knowledge of what's normal. And then at the same time, as you build that confidence, you're like, okay, I have to take a step back and maybe pursue this one further down and do more testing. A lot of atypical presentations, definitely. So let's go ahead and talk about the MLS program. As the audience knows, and we have talked about this before, we have all sorts of programs, you know, where you have like a combination, and we call them like the 2+2, 4+1, where it takes some years with some requirements, and then they do the actual program. So what kind of program is the MLS program at UAA?
So I like to think of our program as a traditional 4-year program. Our students, their first freshman year, if you come in and declare it as an MLS major, you actually come in and declare the major as a freshman, and you take some prerequisite classes, a couple chemistry classes, a couple biology classes, and then you start right away your second year in what we call our MLS and MLT program, and we start with our 100 levels. And then we actually start them right at phlebotomy, and we do laboratory techniques and serology. And the reason we do this is as we're building on, we have what's called an articulated program. So say we have students declared an MLS, they got their GPA is there, they do their application, they're in our cohort, they're gonna start our program. And then they do their phlebotomy, the courses we have that first semester, and then life gets in the way. They've been to school a year and a half, maybe family happens, maybe finances happen. And we say, well, that's okay. We have a internship you can take, and then you can get your phlebotomy and you can sit for the ASCP and you can be a phlebotomist, you know, which is great. They have that right away. They have that. We actually designed our classes. They have that. And we actually do that as an occupational educational certificate. So we have a mixture of our MLT, MLS students, but also some students that are just getting their phlebotomy. So, but let's say they move on. And so then the second classes, the second series of classes they take are all our 200 level classes. And now all MLT and MLS students take those. What's nice about that, along with their general education classes, is the prerequisite classes we have for MLT are the same as MLS. So in other words, if they decide as they're doing this MLT, they think they're only going to do a 2-year program. They're like, wow, I'm really good at this. I'm smarter than I think I am. I really want to get my bachelor's degree. They just keep going. There's no reapplication. There's no different prerequisite they have to get. They have to take other courses for their bachelor of science. You know, we have an excess class they have to take. They've got other things that they have to take for the university, but there's time in the curriculum. There's time in their credits to be able to do that. But if they don't, they can get their MLT then after that second year plus their internship. So the MLT almost takes 3 years. Reason being is that they have a year of prerequisites, and then they take that phlebotomy semester, and then they have a year of 200 levels. But we do that because it allows students, and this became really great during COVID, to at each point in this path to getting an MLS can stop if they need to, and then be able to get a degree or leave the university with something. So even students, sometimes they think they're going to be an MLS, but sometimes they struggle. We don't have the easiest major. And because of that, we say, well, you know, why don't you finish your MLT, work in the field for a while? Because with our program, you just come back in. And in fact, students that have been in our MLT program, assuming they get their prereqs done for their Bachelor of Science for UAA, it's only 3 semesters then to get their Bachelor of Science. So often students will get their associate's degree, then continue while they're working to pick up some of the other humanities classes that they need for their Bachelor of Science for UAA. And then they come back and we have just 3 semesters they take. So they'll start in the September, so fall, spring, and then a summer rotation. So it's a 12-month, and then they have their MLS. And we have a lot of our upper division classes are taught what we call synchronous I-line. So it actually works with their work schedule. But if you don't and you keep going, then you finish up. And so I always say we're 4 years in a summer because we have 2 full semester clinical rotations. One of the strengths in our program, I think, is we have very strong clinical rotations that are not as, or potentially better than what they could get in other facilities. They have full rotations in micro. They have full rotations in blood bank. Besides core lab and all those other areas. And that makes such good graduates. They truly have a strong background before then they work in the clinical lab. So they do, so it's 4 years. And then because we have two semesters of rotation, their second semester is in the summer. So they have a August graduation is what they graduate in August. So that I would say 4 years and a summer.
So when this position about Alaska, right, maybe not, wouldn't be the primary choice a lot of times, you know, that people think of it, okay, I'm going to take this opportunity in Alaska. And I know that you have worked many years and things like that. So was that like something that you saw that open at the time, or why Alaska's, well, specifically, I guess, out of curiosity?
So, you know, like, I don't know. I always was always looking for jobs. You know, I think my dad did when we were growing up. Dad was always looking for the next job, even though he never, ever left a job. He's always looking for the next job. So I'm always looking for the next job. And when I was looking at teaching, you know, I started looking for other, you know, programs. In fact, I applied for a program, I think, at the University of Illinois. So I was, you know, I just was already kind of looking. And when you do that, you get on listservs, you know, I mean, you just, your email sort of, and I have a LinkedIn account and stuff. And so it happened to come into my email is what happened. I got an email link from, and it listed it. And so I thought, and then I was curious. And then Alaska, my husband did have a friend of his from high school that was a mining engineer and then went up there, and that's where he lived. And he always told Jerry, you need to come up and you need to go fishing. And so he had gone a couple of years before I even applied for this. But I still remember when he came back, when I applied, I didn't know if he had gone to Fairbanks or Anchorage, because I couldn't remember. I just remember I sent him up to go salmon fishing. And so we did have that one connection, which did help. I mean, that to some extent that did help, because not that they necessarily helped us in the move so much, but it is helpful on such a big move to have, you know, because it's so far away, to have somebody up there that you kind of know. So that's where, but I don't know that I would have not applied for it, even with that, because like I said, I applied for jobs in Illinois and Indiana, and we didn't have any family in there. But I just remembered that. And the other thing about Alaska is that when I got up there and we flew in April, and there's still snow in April, and Alaska, Anchorage is just different. I mean, it's, I still say that they plan things like, let's build a building here and then we'll build a road to it. I mean, you know, when you come from the cities, you're used to infrastructure and more than just one road, you know, there's just not as much of that up there, which I find very fine. But at the time it was a little disconcerting. But I remember walking on the campus and seeing just this wonderful campus, this beautiful lab, these students, this opportunity to really grow not only, and I wanted to do research. And then that's when I interviewed. I wanted to start a research program in the curriculum, because when I would see students come in that were new grads, they just weren't curious about why an instrument was doing an thing. I mean, like I said, remember, I went back to grad school because I wanted to know all about molecular, because I didn't get it in college, and I needed to know this because these instruments were coming. And I didn't see that curiosity. And I thought, well, you know, maybe if they did research, maybe, you know, if they did some outcome-based research, because I'd been doing outcome-based research, you know, the whole time I worked the bench. I was always asking, why the heck am I doing this test? Or I'd say, why are we setting up all these cultures? Isn't there a better way? You know, back to my whole personality, I want everything to be better, right? Things could be better. And I didn't see that. And I wondered if maybe because I had an opportunity to do research when I was an undergrad way back in the dark ages, and a lot of med lab science programs, at least what I saw them coming out, they had really good education. There's nothing wrong with it. But when I'd ask about what research they got to do, it was always like a capstone lit, you know, lit project, or, you know, not that that's bad, but it was, or a case study, but it wasn't anything that they actually did on the bench where a cause and effect. And I thought, well, you know, there's got to be something we can do in micro. There's got to be something I can do to create a research within the curriculum so that the students would do something, that everything wasn't just mock-up lab and then they go to the hospital. And so all they know about the hospital is just bench work. And so the idea that research came to develop this bench work type of medicine, there was a gap there. There was a real gap. And part of it was our education. When I was going through med lab science, we were actually learning the latest thing coming out. That's why when I was hired, when they asked me, oh, you all know the new stuff, I want you to help us write the procedure manual. It wasn't because I was this super smart student coming out. It's because education was actually that way. We were learning the latest stuff that was coming out when they didn't know it. And we were doing research to help develop the latest stuff that was coming out. Now, of course, medicine and manufacturing's all changed since then. And I mean, we used to reprogram the computer boards and we'd get a new software. I mean, when we'd get a new kit, like CPK, and it was a brand new thing on my analyzer, I would have to pull out the board and rewire the wires. They would give us the electrical schematics to unbundle and bundle the keyboard of the big computer keyboard, because I'm putting on total billies now that I didn't run before on this instrument. So that's how basic instrumentation was when I was in school and when I got out. Can you imagine telling students when they finish that they're gonna have to reprogram computer boards? They just didn't, but the expectation that we'd have to do that was there because that's what we had. So I wanted to do that. I wanted to create an idea of research. And so when I made that leap to Alaska, and when I went up there and I talked to them, the reason I went, because at the time, even at the time, we thought, first of all, I didn't think they'd hire me because I was too old. I was 55. Who hires somebody 55 for a tenure track position? Nobody does. Nobody does. And so I didn't think I was even, I knew I was one of several candidates. So we figured it'd be an opportunity to see Alaska, see his brother's friend, my husband's friend, you know, to just, you know, and see the, and maybe, who knows, right? Throw it against the wall, see if it sticks, right? So we went up there, and then when I saw it and I told them what I wanted to do, and I wanted to create this, and you have a lab, you have a facility, and we can make this phenomenal research-driven program. And when they said, we want you, then how could I say no, right?
I'm going to ask about the research in a minute, but before that, I just wanted to always, you know, like to ask when I have the chance to talk to instructors that teach microbiology. So as part of your curriculum, can you maybe talk a little bit about the type of testing that you do? I know that I heard that on the other podcast that you mentioned that there is like a Vitex, so you do some sort of perhaps some susceptibility testing.
So yeah, again, one of the reasons when I walked into the lab and I saw industry level incubators, I mean the best temperature controlled incubators you could imagine. They were not CO2. I mean, we use candle jars, which actually works very well, by the way. But you know what I mean? High quality, where I could make sure that my temperatures were constant, which as a microbiologist and a research microbiologist is really necessary. And at the time I came, they had a Vitex compact too. So I knew I could do antimicrobial susceptibility testing, being I'd get breakpoints. Now, granted, it was old, but at least I had the equipment there. So when I came onto the campus, one of the things that I was asked to do was to redesign the microbiology courses. The previous instructor was a good instructor, but their test scores were not doing as well. And there was concerns from the advisory board, you know, things that happen. I mean, and that's in teaching all the time. You know, it doesn't hurt to have new curriculum come in. Doesn't really reflect the instructor. Sometimes it's just time, you know. And again, one of the things that I found when I'd have students that would come in, new grads on second shift, their inability to make the leap between a sample that is just something I'm getting tested on and a sample that you're actually going to have to report on this and your initials are going to go behind it and you have confidence to do that. So I redesigned micro to be more of a systems approach teaching, where after they learned all of their basic staph, strep, E. coli, you know, gram negatives, then we apply to them. So it's not always going to be staph week. It's not always going to be strep week. And in fact, when I would have teaching staphylococcus, you know, in micro and lecture, and then we have staph in lab, and then your typical coagulase, you grow it on a plate, you know, you do catalase tests, all those spot tests, and we'd learn that, and we'd start with disc diffusion. So we didn't wait for antimicrobial susceptibility until we got to antimicrobial susceptibility way back when. I actually, once we learned it was staph, and then staph was a wound infection, then the last lab was that we actually had a wound infection that grew staph, and that you had to identify it, you had to report it out, and then you had to do antimicrobial susceptibility testing. And then we did a chromatograph for MRSA. So all of a sudden, the lab is not just demonstration. My lab is now that this is a wound infection. Most common wound infections is staph aureus. We have to be concerned about MRSA. And that because I didn't want that whole huge disc diffusion, all we did was, you know, we did suboxetine, we did an oxicillin, we did an afcillin, you know, and then we did an MRSA plate. And then we talked about, you know, how did we once do the disc diffusion for them? And so all of a sudden MRSA makes a whole lot more sense, you know, in an ampicillin disc, because we're using the antibiotics, but not like a full AST. So as you're building on that, by the time we got to antimicrobial susceptibility testing and we're running the BiTech and we're doing breakpoints, they've been doing disc diffusion and understanding susceptibility in an organic way in MRSA on their third, fourth week of lab. And so that's what I do. And so we teach both a 200 level and a 300 level micro. So the 200 level is that way. They never get more than one patient culture in that week or that couple of weeks. We get to the point where they know how to identify it. They're doing, you know, and then when it comes to the gram negatives, I make them know all of those slants. You know, I know there's like, well, we have MALDI now, right? And we have BiTech, and why do they have to know all that? I go, you know, because MALDI is usually right, but if it's not in the library, it ain't going to give you an answer. BiTech isn't always correct. I mean, you have to be careful. You got to know what it looks like. And sometimes it's really powerful when you see a lactose fermenter and it's indole positive and it's PYR negative. What the heck is it going to be? But all it's going to be is E. coli. You don't really need to run it on that BiTech. I mean, that's power. Knowing those biochemicals is power. Knowing that if it doesn't, something doesn't look right, and you can run a TSI slant and a urease and a citrate, and you got a pretty good idea, at least what major classification it is, that is power. The minute we decide that the molecular or the MALDI is going to dictate it, and we don't think about that, we're going to really lose a sense of there's another way to know what this is. And that also is very good and another method. And it might not give us an exact genus and species, but it might even get us better than whatever our instrument's doing, because our instrument's not, you know, we just don't want to. In micro, you just can't. Plus, there are new bugs all the time. I mean, just because BioMaroa has decided this is going to be on the ID panel doesn't mean that there isn't something new coming down the pike, right? And if we are relying on only the library we're getting from whatever our MALDI is, then we can't. And if we don't have biochemicals, we have no way of saying, what could this be? And if students aren't comfortable with biochemicals, and slants are not hard to do, and they're not expensive. I make my own slants, you know, and they have power. That gives them power because they think of that microorganism as a living being. So we do that. And then, like I said, then we move forward once they have all of that, and then they have identifications. And then they start doing a little bit by the end with what are called standard operating procedures with how do you actually report this out? So we're moving away from just staph is catalase positive, coagulase, you know, all that. Strep is Lancefield typing. Two, I have a baby and it's a neonate. It's a positive blood culture. What are my usual suspects? What are my usual suspects, guys? And even before they even look at that plate, I ask my class, what are my usual suspects? And then they usually, by that time, they'll say, well, staph aureus is always there. Yeah, it's always there. But they, you know, because baby's got to come from infection from somewhere, right? It's going to come from mom, right? There's no spontaneous blood infections. I always say that. There's no spontaneous blood infections coming from somewhere. So it comes from mom. So staph's always there. E. coli is always there. Urinary tract infection. And of course, group B strep. And if you look at anybody's SOPs, that's the top three. Yes, there's Haemophilus, there's Neisseria, but when you talk about the top three, and then there's always Listeria as number four, and it's really cool when you've had students that have been doing micro, and this is the end of the semester, that they're already thinking that way, right? It's not that, oh, we don't have to think about staph, because staph was in the beginning of the semester. We're still thinking about staph, even though we're at the end of the semester, we're talking about antimicrobial susceptibility testing, because that's what we're finally doing. But now, our antimicrobial susceptibility testing is only adding to what's my usual suspects, what's my SOP, what's going to be analyzed, why are we doing it? It's a pure culture. It's on a blood culture. We do ASTs on all blood cultures because every blood culture, for the most part, is considered pathogenic. And they know that. And that's because it built from the very beginning. But if all we do is staph week in the September and October, and then we don't talk about it again until the final exam, then they have no concept that staph is not just staph week, but staph comes everywhere. And I'm even tricky enough that in the middle of the semester, when we're doing gram negatives, I'll give them a culture that's got staph on it. Easy staph aureus. I'm like, what do you do, guys? It's gram positive, catalase positive, coagulase. You guys know this. And then that reinforces that, and I'll do that. And then our second semester was completely redesigned in lab, and everything builds on. So lecture is all application. Everything is systems. I teach the renal system. So we talk about the renal system and all the infections and all the things that occur with this, cardiovascular systems, respiratory systems. So it's not rebooting everything, but we're talking about systems. The only difference is we add all some of those other weird organisms that we don't necessarily, that we've not talked about in the 200 level, which is also our MLT level micro. So, you know, more things on, you know, we hit Bordetella pertussis harder. You know, we're going to hit Francisella tularemia. We're going to hit some of those things that they're still going to see, but what's nice is that everything else is so solid in a clinical setting that when I'm adding these things lecture wise, because you're not going to want to isolate those things in the clinical in your student lab. I'm a strong believer that your student lab needs to be safe. There is no way. I don't even isolate Salmonella because there's no reason to. You can identify it. You can understand it. If they understand how things are and what they look like virtually, I mean, when that's going to grow and the way molecular is doing with most of our stools, most of the time you're going to grow Salmonella. It's going to be on a blood culture because it's going to be a septic Salmonella. They're going to see it on blood culture. There's no reason to grow it in a student lab and to expose students to that. That's my personal opinion. But the concept of that, it's an additional pathogen they have, grows because they have all this basis. And then lab, instead of more demonstration, is actually they come in and they have patient samples. So they'll have staff, they'll strep, they'll gram negatives, and then they have to completely follow an SOP. So they have to go in and they got a urine culture and it comes in and it's a cath. What sample, you know, what plates are you setting up? And there's a chart and they have to go in just like a regular lab. What is your protocol? And I talk about protocols because protocols are different from every micro lab to another micro lab. Now, protocols are in all departments, but micro in a teaching setting, I can teach protocol in a teaching setting in micro easier than chemistry or anything else because I can make it like a micro bench. I can make them look up and say that you're going to set, even if the physician forgot to set up an anaerobe or order an anaerobe on a fluid culture coming from surgery, your SOP says you do routine anaerobe and fungal, right? Because that's what a micro be. And then you got to call the floor and say, don't you know, you got to order these. Or depending on your SOP of your hospital, you may have power to order those. Because I don't want my students to work their first day prep in a lab when there's even students and having a tissue come up and they only have a routine culture ordered, not to say, this is from surgery. Shouldn't we be doing anaerobes? Might be fungal. I want them thinking already that setup process, because if you set up wrong, you're wrong 3 days later. And if it's a tissue from surgery, you're really wrong. And so that's what advance is. Advance isn't let's try to isolate some weird organism and idea. No, that's what lecture is. Advanced is how do I run a micro lab? How do I make certain that I'm identifying everything correctly and I'm setting up correctly and I'm following the SOP correctly so that what's getting reported out is appropriate? And the students don't know this, but two-thirds during the labs that we have, all of a sudden, they get somebody else's plates that week. So they've set everything up on that because we have 3 days of lab and it follows each other. They're doing their setups on Monday and then they come in on Tuesday and they're sitting at somebody else's bench because I give them a different bench assignment and then they got somebody else's stuff. And boy, handwriting becomes really critical. And then it's like, then they're like, well, and then they have to be like, they're the supervisor. Well, what are you going to do? I mean, that person's off skiing. You can't even call them. So how are you going to set this up? What's the error? What's, you know, and so it really, the eye-opening about the fact that you're not going to be the person, in fact, more than likely, if you're working micro, you're not going to look at the stuff that got set up because night shift set it up. I will have a plate that's in process where night shift did the gram stain and they set up the plates. And it's obviously a E. coli on the plate, but I don't let them use McConkey auger because I make them so they know it. And this is advanced, guys. This is advanced, right? But the gram says the gram-positive cocci. The gram stain that was reported out says gram-positive cocci. And you look at this big gray, there's no way this is staph. But if they do a catalase on it, it comes catalase positive. And if they do a coagulase, I'm like, do you really think that's coagulase negative staph? Do you really trust night shift? I mean, I do that to them. I go, do you really trust night shift? Do you maybe should have re-gram stained that? Does it really look like a staph? So that really makes them think. And that's what advanced is. And that's all advanced. We do that from, you know, January when we start until just before spring break. Then we have spring break, and then we do our research cultures. We do some research cultures in there, part of our stool stuff. And then we have, because our stool stuff that we do and our research that we do is separate. So everything else that we do for our, like our, what I call our patient workups, so the like the first, before up until spring break, our meats and potatoes, our, your, you know, wound cultures, your throat cultures, your respiratory cultures, you know, your staphs, your streps, your nothing enteric pathogens. I do that for two reasons. One, because I really want them to know these. I mean, this is the meat, this is urine cultures. That's the meat and potatoes of microbes. Positive blood cultures. That's what I want them to feel really confident on. But also because a lot of, depending on where you're at, a lot of stool stuff is being done molecularly or they're getting sent out. And so the need, but so what I do then is to teach the molecular or to teach the enteric pathogen piece. That's where my research comes in, Lewis. And so what we do is that we actually have cultures that are our stool samples that we collect on the ground. We do environmental collecting of both geese, moose, and bear. And we actually do all the testing on them as normal, except we do enteric pathogens. So the students will set them up on all the plates that we need to, and then including HE, XLD, and then we do a sugar toxin induction broth. We do a selenite induction broth. We do the whole nine yards, campy, the whole thing. But then I also have them, when they get the McConkie plate, they also have to isolate every gram negative because we're also looking at gram negative identification and sensitivity. So what's great about that in advance is that's when we grow things like hafnia and we grow things like Aeromonas. We'll grow Yersinia. We actually grow a lot of Yersinia. We will also grow Pseudomonas fluorescens. And so remember all those unusual organisms that people are trying to grow on mock-up? We don't have to mock those up because students are growing them. They will actually have things that are, you know, we always say oxidase, you know, non-lactose fermenter or oxidase positive is going to be a non-enterobacter ACA. Well, you've got some funky things out there, you know, where the oxidase isn't really all that cause and effect. So then they have to set up a TSI slant. Well, then they're like, oh, obviously we are not fermenting glucose. So, you know, all of a sudden those things, you know, come into play. All of that stuff they've learned, all the reasons why we have slants, that we do that. The concept of a non-enterobacter ACA is basically glucose fermentation, has really nothing to do with oxidase as much. And so that becomes to play. And not because I mock something up, but because we grow weird gram negatives out of stool cultures that are coming from environmental areas. And so they'll do that. And then they'll run all the antimicrobial susceptibilities, both on DISC and on the VITEC. They'll do ESBL screenings, because we screen for ESBL. So all of those advanced things on AST are done then. So that's we do about 4 weeks of that. And then we also do the gram positive. So that's not part of enteric pathogens, but they also grow all the gram positives. So we get a lot of things like Enterococcus galarium, Enterococcus faecalis, and faecium also, but galarium, Castle flavus. So their idea and their concept of bank A and bank B and bank C and acquired and intrinsic and antimicrobial susceptibility really comes into play with that because we're growing it and we're seeing it. So when we talk about, and you know, when we're growing, when we have an Enterococcus galarium and it's vancomycin resistant, they're like, oh, well, yeah, that's not acquired, that's intrinsic. And to see, you know, students that have not even left my school, university, all of a sudden know, well, of course, it's bank C, it's not bank A and bank B. So obviously it's intrinsic. And they understand that because we're doing research and they know they have to get that right. And that's the other thing. By that time, they have the confidence because trusting them to identify these gram negatives, right? I mean, I go back and I verify a lot of stuff. That's why I do it during spring break. That's why I don't get a spring break. But they are doing the original. I mean, they want to be right, right? And so the concept that this culture means something, they make that leap and they really take it seriously. And so we do that for about 3 weeks, 4 weeks before and after spring break. And then we clean up with all the usual management and things like that. And virology, I do fungal. I do some fungal plates. I grow stuff. I start growing fungi over spring break. And so they have fungi to look at. And we do have a biosafety level 2 cabinet that they can work in. But when we do the management stuff, the really cool thing about the management stuff is, you know, the antibiotic ambiogram that they do and, you know, when you have to do the IQPC, you know, piece, they actually do that and all the data that they did when they were running patient samples. They've been running patient samples for, you know, 8-9 weeks. And so they've got how many urines. And so I make them ask, they do all the statistics that you do. How many urines did you run? How many throats did you run? How many positive MRSAs did you run? And then they also have to go in and find something that they made a mistake on and actually act like a manager and say, okay, so this is your error. What would you do if you're management? I mean, what is, that's that whole, you know, quality assurance, quality control. You know, what outcome happened? You know, what was the problem? What happened to that patient? had you not run that AST correctly, or that you missed that identification, or you decided that you weren't going to regram stain that blood culture, and now you reported out a staph epidermidis to something that was E. coli. I mean, what's the outcome to that? And so it really makes them think about that. And then we do quality, you know, every day they come in, they have to take temperatures. Every day I make them take temperatures, just like they're working a regular lab. They got to take the refrigerator temperature, freezer temperature, and they have to do that. And they average that at the, you know, like you're supposed to, you know how you have to have that at your statistic that you do? I make them average. I make them see if there's any outliers, you know, so all the stats that you do for other things, I make them do that. I mean, you know, so what are your, they have to do a media check. They have to check that all the things, if you're having any kind of a CAP survey or whatever, you know, an inspection comes in. Are you cleaning your bench every day? I make them check that they clean their bench every day. You know, they have a regular sheet they've got to fill out, just like they're working on a regular bench. It was so great. I had one student that did a clinical rotation and she automatically started taking temperatures. You know, she was at a smaller hospital. And they felt so bad after she left, because now they're going to take temperatures again. Because every morning she'd come in and she'd take temperatures, you know, because that's what you do in the lab. But she was so used to doing it in my micro class that it didn't occur to her not to ask. I always tell the students to go ask before you do something. But you can ask them, you know how to take temperatures. They've been taking temperatures all semester. They know how to read a thermometer. They know how to read the outside temperature and the inside temperature. So they've been doing it all semester long, right? Because I make them do that in micro. Not that micro always has it that way, but that way they know that sometimes there is an external thermometer and an internal thermometer. So I actually do that. I have one of my refrigerators has an external thermometer. So I put one internally. So they're used to having to, and every day they do that. And that rote memory is there. And so, yeah, because usually blood bank has that. But of course, we're not going to have a blood bank refrigerator, right? So we're not going to have that capability. So that's why I do it in micro, even though it's a little overkill in micro, but it gets them used to looking at that. So anyways, that's my labs.
Wow, that is wonderful. And I just want to ask, I'm not going to take too much more of your time, but as far as based on the research, so from what I was listening to the podcast, right? So they're collecting samples from from moose, right? And that's what they're using to set up they're doing the test on.
So yeah, and I didn't know how much of the research, because it's a whole another topic. And if you ever want me to come back again, we'll talk about it. So in Anchorage, we have what we call urban wildlife, and it's something that is really a part of our life. So we have about 1,500 to 1,600 urban moose that are in the Anchorage Bowl area. We are surrounded by the Chugach Mountains. They come down. They learned that they don't like to stand in the snow, and they learn that we plow. So they actually come down when it snows so that they don't have to stand in snow. So it's a real problem sometimes in the winter. As a side note, you can be late for school if a moose is in your driveway and you can't get out, and that's actually an okay excuse, because that happens. So when I came to Anchorage, and you talk about how you are curious, and remember the whole idea that I did all this because I'm curious, is I'm walking around all these large piles of moose scat, and they're like little nuggets. But when I mean piles, it's probably a 14-inch diameter. I mean, these huge piles, and we're all walking around them like they're no big deal. And I kept thinking, okay, I'm a micro person. There's got to be something, or there could be something. But everybody kept saying they were innocuous. There's nothing wrong with them. And I was really, and this is my first year here, I'm thinking, huh. So I had a handful of students. That was going to be winter break. And I go, so you guys are going to be bored over winter break? You want to do something? Because I was kind of curious. And so we collected some. Brown collected them. We put it in a thio broth. And I subcultured it. And oh my God, I couldn't believe what was growing. I mean, I couldn't believe the resistance we had. And so we did a small project, just me and these two other students. And I had already done CTI training for, for researching, because I wanted to make sure I brought research into the university. So I had all that taken care of. Back to where you want to make sure that you get all your training, your ducks in a row, so when an opportunity happens, it's there. Because I didn't think anything was going to grow. So I knew this was a project. And so I conned these students into working with me all winter break, 40 hours a week, because I didn't know what it was, but I knew we had something. And it was the first paper that we actually sent, and we saw significant antimicrobial resistance. And at that time, I had microscan panels that had been donated with me, and we still use microscan. We use microscan for our IDs, but I like my Vitek for my breakpoints. I get better breakpoints. And my microscan panels were only for urine, because they just were donated to us. And so they've given us a good ID, but the urine's not the same antimicrobial susceptibility testing that I wanted to do. So anyways, but that's what we started out with. And even with that, I knew we were coming up with potential ESBLs because, of course, they were designed for, you know, the cephalosporins and the breakpoints. And I'm like, oh my God. And I had the discs. So then we confirmed it with disc diffusion. And we're like, oh my God, we have ESBLs. I had no idea. I had no idea. So that's where it started. And so then I realized that we needed to create something. We needed to. So that first year, I worked with a handful of students to develop at least some kind of protocol because nobody was doing it. I did some lit review over the summer, the next summer, and found out about some reindeer. And so then we started collecting moose, bear, and geese scat. It also became to my attention that we eat moose. I mean, we are a subsistent diet. And so I was concerned about enteric pathogens because no one tests for it because it's not a commodity. And that just lines right into enteric pathogens with our, you know, with our students. And so instead of doing any kind of mock-up, so the first year was the only year I did sort of pretend stools. After that, everything we did with stool samples we were collecting, we actually set them up. And as we were getting more information and I was getting more, things were coming out, then the hospitals really recognized the importance. So we were getting lots of good donated media. I was getting some funding from the university. And so we were constantly coming up with different ways to do things and making sure we were consistent and validating. And so what we found is a significant amount of antimicrobial resistance and mostly in different ones for different populations. Cause again, we do moose, bear, and geese. We have significant changes in antimicrobial resistance. So it's become a survey, which is really important. So we collect samples in the spring, collect moose samples in the spring, and then we keep them frozen. And then we analyze them the following year. So it kind of mimic the Alaska environment. So so it's frozen and then it thaws in a moist environment, what grows. And so for us, it's not so important what grows, but often the only thing that grows. So the concept of mixed flora becomes really apparent to the students. So here we have a stool sample and the idea of mixed and sterile. And I mean, I'm telling you, they learn so much about cultures because we're doing things that are actual real samples. So yeah, tremendous amount of antimicrobial resistance right now, at least for moose. And of course, it's a little different. And again, could do an entire podcast on this and my results. But as just some broad aspects, 71% of any moose scat that you would approach pile in the Anchorage Bowl area has one or more multi-drug resistant microorganism that you would isolate from that sample, 71%. And I had a student that did a really good deal because we were collecting, and we had all this data. And so she actually mapped it all. We don't know how many moose are doing this. We don't really care. It could be one typhoid Mary moose that's defecating everywhere. But what we look at is high impact areas of human and animal interaction, you know, so areas where we have unsecured camping, homeless, recreation, you know, wherever we could have that. And so she mapped that out and found out it didn't even matter, statistically speaking, where in Anchorage you were. So in other words, whether you were along the creek beds, you were just as higher risk as if you were in some of the residential areas, which I thought was really important data to come with. And so that was one of my, I had a student, I had a departmental honor student, and that was one of her projects. She did some of, because we've gotten enough numbers. We've analyzed over 350 moose samples and all my students do it in class. Nobody gets out of doing research. Every student does it.
Oh, I love this. And we'll definitely, I will reach out and I would love to hear more about this in detail. So if you're willing to come back and talk about it, I will definitely be very happy to have you and chat some more about that.
Yeah, because we do it under the One Health model. And I'd really like to talk about the One Health model. I'm going to be speaking at the ASCLS conference under the One Health, the concept of One Health. I think it's, you know, the idea that we're not the end of everything, that it's us and animals and environment. And I think healthcare has come a little bit lower to the table when we talk about One Health, and our research is actually the One Health model. And so I think it's so if people are interested or are listening to this, if you come to the ASCLS conference in Pittsburgh, I'll be speaking. I was on Tuesday, but I think they changed my day. They had to move me. But anyway, so I am speaking. So please come, or virtually, please come and you'll listen a little bit and you'll hear a little bit more about our research, but also why our research is so important and so impactful in our health when it comes to microbiology. And then if anyone is going to the ASM conference, we are also speaking at ASM, but it's more on our targeted, because we're also finding carbonipase producing microorganisms. And so every one of classifications, so E. coli, Citrobacter, Hafnia, Actinobacter, and my head, I'm so bad. And Klebsiella. So all those classifications, we have every one of those, we have isolated one that was not only an ESBL, but also was a carbamazepine paste. And so that's all we'll be speaking about is our carbamazepine. That's a change over time. So we did not find a carbamazepine paste producing E. coli until last year. So that's not something that we saw in the beginning. So we have a trend that we're seeing and of resistance. And, you know, and we're talking about moose scat. We're not talking about human samples. We're just talking about moose scat that we're collecting in the Anchorage Bowl area since 2018. And so I'll be speaking on that at the ASM conference in Atlanta. So if you're anyone happening, you need to go to the ASM conference, I'll be speaking there also. So we're getting the word out. Our little research program from the Medical Laboratory Science Project Department, which I think is pretty cool, right? I mean, MLS, way to go, right? We're doing cutting edge research in our program.
I love it. And definitely for the listeners, you know, if you attend any of those conferences, and I told the audience, you know, I'll be attending Microbe this year, and I'm participating in two events. So I'll definitely make sure that look you up and listen to yours. Well, you know, Grace, this has been so great. And I love what you're doing with the students. And right, this is, especially when it comes to microbiology, there's so much information, and it seems like, you know, you're preparing them. And it's definitely, I always talk about this and knowing your biochemicals. And sometimes, you know, we get all these new instruments and all this technology, and we might become a little too reliant on it. So it's definitely, we should definitely build that knowledge. And like I always like to say, you know, by the time you're putting it on the instrument, you pretty much have a really good idea what you have, and you're just proceeding to prove it. Sometimes, you know, as you said, if it's done in the database, you can get a weird ID. And so it's always very important to do things like your gram stain. And sometimes, you know, you get some organisms, you know, they don't grow McConkie. So don't assume that they're not gram negative and things like that can lead you to make some serious mistakes. So those basic and knowing your biochemicals, you know, your gram stains and things like that, it definitely help you when you're making your determination. So as we're getting ready to wrap up the episode, as I said, you know, I'm taking a lot of your time, but is there anything else that you want to tell the audience?
Well, for one thing is that as young people, if you're listening to this, you don't have to have everything figured out, you know, at 23 or at 30 or at 35. If you are always keeping yourself open to new ideas, I think I read somewhere where, you know, the year of saying yes. I mean, it doesn't mean you have to say yes to everything, but sometimes when an opportunity comes, and even though it may be out of your comfort zone, saying yes might open doors to an avenue that you never expected, stretches you farther than you have. And every time that you say yes to something, you grow. And so the next time it won't be maybe quite so scary to say yes. Had I not, you know, moved to South Dakota and then moved to Kansas, and, you know, and done some things, it would have been harder to move to Alaska. So even though it sometimes seems when you're a MLS student and you do a rotation at a hospital and you're comfortable and then they hire you there, it just seems such an easy thing to do. And yet I want to tell you, sometimes when you're young, try to stretch yourself a little bit every time that opportunity comes, because then when other opportunities come when you're older, it might be easier to make that move. Or sometimes when they're put upon you and you have no choice, but you have built this ability to stretch a little bit out of your comfort zone, even something as minor as, okay, yeah, I'll be the lead on this instrument. I mean, it doesn't have to be that you make this huge move, but every time you do something, even as little as that, it prepares you for when you might have to, because you might have to make a bigger leap, but you'll have that foundation. So don't be afraid to say yes. Because otherwise, I told my students, if I did everything I said I was going to be, I'd have been a nun working in Argonne Labs in Chicago. So, you know, life doesn't always work that way. And by saying, letting yourself, like I said, stretch yourself, it's a good thing to do. You don't have to have it all figured out. Just take those chances when measured chances. And then, of course, as my husband say, got to have a backup. And if you can't have a backup for the backup, you know, you always have that plan B. And when I was moving to Alaska, and it was really scary. It was scary. I was leaving my house, a job of 35 years. This was not an easy move, okay? And we're moving across in a pickup truck across Canada for 7 days. It took us 7 days to move across Canada. And I didn't know. And then my husband left me because he had the farm. So he dumps me in Alaska, and then he leaves me, you know, for the first 6 weeks, right? And it was scary. But I remember my one daughter goes, oh, mom, I'm sure they could use you to work second shift blood bank at Providence Hospital if it really is bad. This really is not what you want to do. If you really have to bail, you have that backup plan. Remember, Mom, that backup plan. You've got those skills, right? Like, yeah. Because well, you've got that, then go ahead, try. What's the worst that can happen? You're going to be working night shift at Prov until next year or whatever. And so that also helps. So saying yes and then always recognizing you got a backup plan. And if your backup plan, that's okay, then just take that leap. Because what's the worst that can happen, right?
Yeah, that's wonderfully said. So, you know, once again, you know, it's been such a pleasure talking to you. And as I said to the audience, you know, if you're make sure that if you're attending Microbe this year, you know, look up our talks, and I'm definitely looking forward to meeting people and attending some great events. This conference, they're really great, and I always encourage people to, if they have the chance to attend them, to go ahead and do so. So once again, Grace, you know, thank you so much for taking the time to being on Let's Talk Micro.
It's been a pleasure for me too.
And that, my dear audience, is the end of this episode. I hope you enjoy learning about the MLS program at the University of Alaska in Anchorage. As always, I enjoy sharing this information with you. What a great educator. I love what she's doing with the students, how she's preparing them, her way of thinking about knowing about the biochemicals and the organisms. And sometimes, you know, we become too complacent with technology. And as microbiologists, we need to know the organisms, their reactions. You know, sometimes organisms are not in the database of instruments. Things can go wrong. You know, I have spoken about this many times. So it is good to build a solid foundation. So it was so great listening to her. And she's going to be at ASM Microbe this year in Atlanta. So if you're planning on attending, look her up, you know, look her up in the schedule, check her talk and go listen and attend it. I'm planning on doing that and meeting her in person as well. And if I see you in Microbe, you know, say hi. I'm looking forward to meeting you. Thank you so much for the support. Recently, the podcast celebrated its third year. So thank you for listening. Thank you for downloading episodes. And stay tuned. Great things coming your way. Please continue bringing that passion to what you do. It's so important. You do such great work. So, as always, stay motivated, stay safe, and of course, continue talking micro. Until the next time. Bye.